This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Rich People Problems by Kevin Kwan. Read for you by Lydia Look. Problem number one. Your regular table at the fabulous restaurant on the exclusive island where you own a beach house is unavailable. Bettina Ortiz Emena was not accustomed to waiting. A former Miss Venezuela and Miss Universe runner-up, of course. The exceedingly bronzed, strawberry blonde was these days the wife of the Miami auto parts tycoon, Herman Ortiz Emena. And at every restaurant she chose to grace with her presence, she was always greeted with reverence and whisked to the exact table she desired. Today, she wanted the corner table on the terrace at Sip Sip, her favorite lunch spot on Harbor Island. She wanted to sit on one of the comfy orange canvas director's chairs and stare out at the gently lapping turquoise waters while eating her kale Caesar salad. But there was a large, noisy group taking up the entire terrace, and they didn't seem in much hurry to leave. Bettina fumed as she glared at the tourists happily savoring their lunch in the sun. Look how tacky they were. The women overly tanned, wrinkled, and saggy, none of them properly lifted or Botoxed. She felt like walking up to their table and handing out her dermatologist's business cards. And the men were even worse, all dressed in old, rumpled shirts and shorts, wearing those cheap straw hats sold at the trinket shop on Dunmore Street. Why did such people have to come here? This 3.5-mile-long paradise with its pristine pink sand beaches was one of the best-kept secrets in the Caribbean, a haven for the very rich filled with quaint little wood houses painted in shades of sherbet, charming boutiques, chic oceanfront mansions turned into inns, and 5-star restaurants to rival St. Bart's. Tourists should have to take a style exam before being allowed to set foot on the island. Feeling like she had been patient long enough, Bettina stormed into the kitchen, the fringe on her crocheted poochie caftan top shaking furiously as she made a beeline for the woman with a shock of pixie-cut blonde hair manning the main stove.
Julie, honey, what's the dealio? I've waited more than 15 minutes for my table.
Bettina sighed to the owner of the restaurant.
Sorry, Bettina. It's been one of those days. The party of 12 on the terrace showed up just before you did, Julie replied as she handed off a bowl of spicy conch chili to a waiting server.
But the terrace is your prime spot. Why on earth did you let those tourists take up all that space?
Well, that tourist in the red fishing cap is the Duke of Glencora. His party just boated over from Windermere. That's his royal husman you see moored off the coast.
Isn't it the most handsome sailboat you've ever seen?
I'm not impressed by big boats, Bettina huffed.
Although secretly, she was rather impressed by people with big titles. From the kitchen window, she surveyed the party assembled on the terrace with new eyes. These aristo-British types were such a strange breed. Sure, they had their Savile Row suits and their heirloom tiaras, but when they traveled, they looked so painfully frumpy. It was only then that Bettina noticed 3 tan, well-built men in fitted white T-shirts and black Kevlar pants sitting at the adjacent table. The guys weren't eating, but sat watchfully, sipping glasses of seltzer water.
I assume that's the Duke's security detail? They couldn't be more obvious. Don't they know that we're all billionaires here on Brylan and this isn't how we roll?
Footnote. A slight exaggeration, but this island, known affectionately as Brylan to the locals, is home to 12 billionaires at last count, and depending on who's counting.
Bettina tut-tutted. Actually, those bodyguards belong to the Duke's special guest. They did a whole sweep of the restaurant before the party arrived. They even searched my walk-in freezer.
See that Chinese fella seated at the end of the table?
Bettina squinted through her Dior Ecstasy sunglasses at the portly, balding, 70-something Asian man dressed in a nondescript white short-sleeved golf shirt and gray trousers.
Oh, I didn't even notice him. Am I supposed to know who he is?
That's Alfred Chang, Julie said in a hushed tone. Bettina giggled.
He looks like their chauffeur. Doesn't he look like that guy that used to drive Jane Wyman around in Falcon Crest?
Julie, who was trying to focus on searing a cut of tuna to perfection, shook her head with a tight-lipped smile. From what I hear, that chauffeur is the most powerful man in Asia.
What's his name again?
Alfred Chang. He's Singaporean, but lives mostly in England on an estate that's half the size of Scotland, so I'm told.
Well, I've never seen his name on any of the rich lists, Bettina sniffed.
Bettina, I'm sure you know that there are people on this planet who are far too rich and powerful to ever appear on those lists. Problem number two. The 24-hour on-call personal physician that you have on $1 million annual retainer is busy attending to another patient. Sitting on the terrace overlooking Harbor Island's legendary beach, Alfred Chang marveled at the spectacular sight before him. It's true. The sand really is pink.
Alfred, your lobster quesadillas are going to get cold, the Duke of Glencora piped up, interrupting his reverie.
So this is the reason you dragged me all the way here, Alfred said, staring dubiously at the triangular wedges placed artfully before him.
He didn't really care much for Mexican food, except when the chef of his good friend Slim in Mexico City was doing the cooking.
Try it before you judge it.
Alfred took a careful bite, saying nothing, as the combination of semi-crisp tortilla, lobster, and guacamole worked its magic.
Marvelous, isn't it? I've been trying to convince the chef at Wilton's to replicate this for years, the Duke said.
They haven't changed a thing at Wilton's in half a century. I don't think there's much of a likelihood they would ever put this on their menu.
Alfred laughed, picking up a stray lobster chunk that had fallen onto the table with his fingers and popping it into his mouth. His phone began to vibrate in his trouser pocket. He took it out and stared at the screen in annoyance. Everyone knew that he was not to be disturbed on his annual fishing trip with the Duke. The screen read, Tiesel, upstairs, secure. This was his elder sister, Sui, the only person whose calls he would take no matter the hour. He picked up immediately, and an unexpected voice said in Cantonese.
Mr. Chang, this is Ah Ling.
It took him a few seconds to register that it was the housekeeper at Tiesel Park.
Oh, Ling Tse?
Footnote. Cantonese for elder sister. Often used as a term of familiarity for household help in the way that boy is sometimes used as in Sonny Boy or Johnny Boy.
I was instructed by my lady to call you. She was feeling very unwell tonight and has just been taken to the hospital. We think it's a heart attack.
What do you mean you think? Did she have a heart attack or didn't she?
Alfred's plummy Queen's English suddenly shifting into Cantonese in alarm.
She didn't have any chest pains, but she was sweating profusely and then she vomited. She said she could feel her heart racing.
Ah Ling stuttered nervously.
And did Prof. Un come over?
Alfred asked.
I tried to reach the doctor on his cell phone, but it went straight to voicemail. Then I called his house and someone there said he was in Australia.
Why are you doing all the calling? Isn't Victoria at home?
Mr. Chang, isn't Victoria in England?
Alamak.
He had completely forgotten that his niece, Sui's daughter, who lived at Tiersel Park, was at this moment at his house in Surrey, no doubt embroiled in some inane gossip fest with his wife and daughter.
How about Felicity? Didn't she come over?
Alfred inquired about Sui's eldest daughter, whose house was nearby on Nassim Road.
Mrs. Leung could not be reached tonight. Her maid said she was in church, and she always turns off her mobile phone when she's in the house of God.
Bloody useless, all of them.
Well, did you call an ambulance?
No, she didn't want an ambulance. Vikram drove her to the hospital in the Daimler, accompanied by her lady's maids and two Gurkhas. But before she left, she said you would know how to contact Professor Un.
Okay, okay, I'll take care of it, Alfred said in a huff, hanging up the phone. Everyone at the table was staring at him expectantly. Oh my, that did sound rather serious, the Duke said, pursing his lips worriedly. I'll just be a moment. Please carry on, Alfred said, getting up from his chair. The bodyguards trailed after him as he strode through the restaurant and out the door to the garden. Alfred hit another number on his speed dial. Prof. Un, home. A woman picked up the phone.
Is this Olivia?
Alfred Chang here.
Oh, Alfred, are you looking for Francis?
Yes, I'm told he's in Australia.
Why the bloody hell did they have this doctor on a $1 million retainer if he was never available?
He just left an hour ago for Sydney. He's doing a triple bypass tomorrow on that actor who won an Oscar for...
So he's on a plane right now. Alfred cut her off.
Yes, but he'll be arriving in a few hours if you need to...
Just give me his flight number. Alfred snapped. He turned to one of his bodyguards and asked,
Who has the Singapore phone? Somebody get Istana on the line right now.
Footnote. Malay for palace. In this instance, Alfred is referring to Istana in Singapore, the official residence of the president. Turning to another bodyguard, he said,
And please order me another of those lobster quesadillas.
Problem number 3. Your airplane is forced to land before you can finish drinking your Dom Perignon. East Java, Indonesia. The silk sheets had just been turned down in the first-class suites. The enormous double-decked Airbus A380-800 had reached a comfortable cruising altitude of 38,000 feet, and most of the passengers were comfortably ensconced in their seats, scanning through the latest movie offerings. Moments later, the pilots of Singapore Airlines Flight 231, bound for Sydney, received the most unusual instructions from Jakarta Air Traffic Control as they flew over Indonesian airspace. Air Traffic Controller.
Singapore, 231, Super Jakarta.
Pilot.
Singapore, 231, Super. Go ahead.
ATC.
I have been instructed to have you turn around immediately and return to Singapore Changi Airport.
Pilot. Jakarta, you want us to return to Singapore Changi?
ATC. Yes. Turn the plane around and return immediately to Singapore. I have the amended route advice ready to copy.
Pilot.
Jakarta, what is the reason for the course change?
ATC.
I don't have that information, but this is a direct order from the Directorate General of Civil Aviation.
The pilots looked at each other in disbelief.
Should we really be doing this? The captain wondered aloud. We'll have to dump a 250,000 liters of fuel before we can land.
Just then, the aircraft's selective calling radio system lit up with an incoming message. The co-pilot read the message quickly and gave the captain an incredulous look.
Walan! It's from the Minister of Freaking Defense! He says to go back to Singapore pronto!
When the airplane made an unexpected landing at Changi Airport just 3 hours after it had departed, the passengers were disoriented and startled by the strange turn of events. An announcement was made over the intercom. Ladies and gentlemen, due to an unexpected event, we have made an emergency diversion back to Singapore. Please remain in your seats with your seat belts fastened, as our flight to Sydney will resume immediately after refueling. Two men in discreet dark suits came aboard and approached the man seated in Suite 3A, Professor Francis Un, Singapore's leading cardiologist.
Professor Un, I'm Lieutenant Ryan Chen from SID.
Footnote. The Security and Intelligence Division, Singapore's equivalent of America's CIA or Britain's MI5, is so secretive that most people don't even know it exists. But yes, that man eating fishball on a stick outside NTUC Fairprice could be the Singaporean James Bond, and you wouldn't even know it.
Please come with us.
We're leaving the plane?
Professor Un asked, utterly baffled. One minute he was in the middle of watching Gone Girl, and the next minute the plane had landed back in Singapore. He hadn't even recovered from the film's jaw-dropping plot twist.
Lieutenant Chen nodded curtly.
Yes, please gather up all your belongings. You won't be returning to this flight.
But,
what did I do?
Professor Un asked, suddenly feeling uneasy.
Don't worry, you didn't do anything, but we need to get you off this plane now.
Am I the only one leaving?
Yes, you are. We are escorting you directly to Mount Elizabeth Hospital. You have been requested to attend to a VIP patient.
At that moment, Professor Un knew something must have happened to Shang Su-yi. Only the Shangs had the kind of influence to turn around a Singapore Airlines flight with 440 passengers on board.
Part 1.
The only thing I like about rich people is their money.
Nancy Astor, Viscountess Astor. Chapter 1. Davos, Switzerland.
Edison Ching stared up at the soaring honeycomb-structured ceiling in the vast white auditorium, feeling on top of the world.
I'm here. I'm finally here.
After years of Olympic-level networking, Eddie had at long last made it.
He had been invited to attend the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos.
Strictly by invitation only.
Footnote. And if you happen to get invited, just know you're still obliged to pay the $20,000 attendance fee unless you are one of the people listed in the next footnote. Beautiful people never have to pay for anything.
This prestigious event was the most elite schmoozefest on the planet.
Every January, the world's most important heads of state, politicians, philanthropists, CEOs, tech leaders, thought leaders, social activists, social entrepreneurs, and of course movie stars. Leo, Brad, Angelina, and Bono have all attended.
Would descend upon the secluded ski resort high in the Swiss Alps in their private jets, check into their luxurious hotels, put on their $5,000 ski jackets and ski boots, and engage in meaningful dialogues about such urgent issues as global warming and rising inequality. And now Eddie was part of this ultra-exclusive club. As the recently appointed senior executive vice chairman of Private Banking Global for the Lichtenberg Group, he now found himself standing in the middle of the futuristic auditorium at the Congress Center, breathing in the rarefied air and catching slivers of his own reflection in the thin chrome leg of an auditorium chair. He was wearing his new bespoke Sartoria Repens suit, which had been outfitted with an inner lining of 10-ply cashmere so that he never had to wear a ski jacket over it. His new Corthay squirrel suede chukkas had special rubber soles so he would never slip on the slick alpine streets. On his wrists was his newest horological acquisition, a rose gold, a Lange Ansorna Richard Lange Pour le Mérite, peeking out the precise amount from his sleeve cuff so other waterfowls would see what he was wearing. But most important of all was what he wore over the sartorial splendor, a black lanyard at the end of which was attached a white plastic badge with his name printed in the middle, Edison Ching. Eddie fondled the slick plastic badge as if it were a jewel-encrusted amulet, personally bestowed on him by the god of Davos. This badge distinguished him from all the peons at the conference. He wasn't some PR hack, journalist, or one of the common attendees. This white plastic badge with the blue line at the bottom meant that he was an official delegate. Eddie glanced around the room at all the clusters of people in hushed conversations, trying to see which dictator, despot, or director he could recognize and connect with. Out of the corner of his eye, he spotted a tall Chinese man wearing a bright orange ski parka, peeking in through the auditorium side door, seemingly a little lost.
Wait a minute. I know that guy.
Isn't that Charlie Wu?
Oi! Charlie!
Eddie yelled a little too loudly as he rushed over toward Charlie. Wait till he sees my official delegate badge. Charlie beamed at him in recognition.
Eddie Cheng! Did you just get in from Hong Kong?
I came from Milan, actually. I was at the men's fall fashion shows, front row seat at Etro.
Wow, I guess being one of Hong Kong Tattle's best-dressed men is serious work, isn't it?
Charlie quipped.
Actually, I made it into the Best Dress Hall of Fame last year,
Eddie replied earnestly.
He gave Charlie a quick once-over, noticing that he was wearing khaki pants with cargo pockets and a navy blue pullover under his bright orange parka.
What a pity. He used to be so fashionable when he was younger, and now he's dressed like every other tech geek nobody.
Where's your badge, Charlie?
Eddie asked, flashing his own proudly.
Oh, yes. We're supposed to wear them at all times, aren't we?
Thanks for reminding me. It's somewhere buried in my messenger bag.
Charlie dug around for a few seconds before fishing out his badge, and Eddie glanced at it, his curiosity morphing into shocked dismay. Charlie was holding an all-white badge affixed with a shiny holographic sticker.
Fucky fuck. This was the most coveted badge. The one they only gave to world leaders.
The only other person he had seen so far wearing that badge was Bill Clinton. How the fuck did Charlie get one? All he did was run Asia's biggest tech company.
Trying to mask his envy, Eddie blurted.
Hey, are you attending my panel? Apocalypse Asia. How to secure your assets when the China bubble really bursts.
I'm actually on my way to give a talk to IGWEL,
the acronym for Informal Gathering of World Economic Leaders, the most exclusive inner sanctum of the conference, so secretive that their meetings take place at an undisclosed location deep within the Congress Center.
What time do you go on?
2 o'clock. What's your talk about?
Eddie asked, thinking that he could somehow tag along with Charlie.
I don't have anything prepared, really. I think Angela Merkel and some of the Scandinavians just wanted to pick my brain.
Just then, Charlie's executive assistant, Alice, walked up to join them.
Alice, look who I found. I knew we'd bump into someone from back home sooner or later, Charlie said.
Mr. Cheng, so nice to see you here.
Charlie, could I have a quick word?
Sure. Alice glanced at Eddie, who looked only too eager for her to continue while he was standing right there.
Would you mind coming with me for a moment?
She said diplomatically, guiding Charlie into a side reception room furnished with several lounge chairs and glass cube coffee tables.
What's up? Are you still trying to recover from sitting at the same breakfast table with Pharrell?
Charlie teased. Alice smiled tensely.
There's been a developing situation all morning, and we didn't want to disturb you until we knew more.
Well, spit it out.
Alice took a deep breath before beginning.
I just got the latest update from our head of security in Hong Kong. I don't quite know how to tell you this, but Chloe and Delphine are missing.
What do you mean, missing?
Charlie was stunned. His daughters were under round-the-clock surveillance, and their pickups and drop-offs were handled with military precision by his SAS-trained security team. Missing was not a variable in their lives.
Team Chungking was scheduled to pick them up outside Diocesan at 3:50 p.m., but the girls couldn't be located at the school.
Couldn't be located? Charlie mumbled in shock.
Alice continued.
Chloe didn't respond to any of her texts, and Delphine never showed up for choir at 2.
They thought maybe she sneaked off with her classmate, Catherine Chan, to that frozen yogurt shop like she did last time. But then Catherine turned up at choir practice and Delphine didn't. Did either of them activate their panic codes? Charlie asked, trying to remain calm.
No, they didn't. Their phones both appear to have been deactivated, so we can't trace them. Team 2046 has already spoken with Commander Kwok. The Hong Kong police have been placed on high alert. We also have four of our own teams searching everywhere for them, and the school is now reviewing all their security camera footage with Mr. Tin. I'm assuming someone's talked to their mother?
Charlie's wife, from whom he was estranged, lived in their house on the peak, and the children spent every other week with her.
Isabel can't be reached. She told the housekeeper that she was meeting her mother for lunch at the Kowloon Cricket Club, but her mother reports that they haven't spoken all week.
Just then, the cell phone rang again, and Alice quickly answered. She listened in silence, nodding her head every now and then. Charlie looked at her pensively. This couldn't be happening. This couldn't be happening. 10 years ago, his brother Rob had been kidnapped by the 11-finger triad. It was like deja vu all over again.
Okay, tote.
Cantonese for thank you. Alice said, hanging up. Looking at Charlie, she reported.
That was the leader of Team Angels. They now think that Isabel might have left the country. They spoke to the upstairs maid and Isabel's passport is missing. But for some reason, she didn't take any suitcases.
Isn't she in the middle of some new treatment?
Yes, but apparently she didn't show up at her psychiatrist's appointment this week.
Charlie let out a deep sigh. This wasn't a good sign. Chapter 2 Fullerton Hotel, Singapore. Every month, Rosalind Fung, the property heiress, hosted a Christian fellowship banquet for 300 of her closest girlfriends in the opulent ballroom of the Fullerton Hotel. An invitation to this occasion was highly coveted by a certain segment of Singapore society, regardless of their religious affiliation, as it was a seal of approval from the old guard. There wasn't a single Chindo or mainlander in sight. And also because the food was heavenly. Rosalind brought in her personal chefs, who took over the hotel's kitchens for one day and prepared an enormous buffet feast consisting of the most mouth-watering Singaporean dishes. Most important, this biblical bacchanal was completely free of charge thanks to Rosalind's generosity. Although guests were asked to contribute something to the offering basket immediately following the closing prayer, most of the guests left $5 or $10 each, except Mrs. Lee Yong Chen, who never left anything. I do all my giving through the Lee Family Foundation, was what she always said. Having strategically chosen a table closest to the buffet area, Daisy Fu sighed as she watched Araminta Lee standing in line at the noodle station dishing out some mee siam.
Aiya, that Araminta. Bin ka ani lao.
Hokkien for gotten so old.
She doesn't look old. She just doesn't have any makeup on, that's all. Those supermodel types look like nothing on earth without makeup.
Nadine Shaw said as she tucked into a steaming bowl of mee rebus noodles.
Dousing her mee goreng with more chili oil, Eleanor Young commented.
It has nothing to do with that. I used to see her swim at the Churchill Club, and even when she was coming out of the pool dripping wet, she looked beautiful without a stitch of makeup on. Her face has just taken a turn, that's all. She has one of those faces that I always knew would age badly. What is she? 27? 28 now? It's all over for her, la!
At that moment, Lorena Lim and Carol Tai arrived at the table with plates piled dangerously high with food.
Wait, who's aging badly?
Lorena inquired eagerly.
Araminta Lee, over at that table with all the cool women. Doesn't she look haggard?
Nadine said.
Alamak! Bite your tongue, Nadine. Didn't you know she just had a miscarriage?
Carol whispered. The ladies all stared at Carol, mouths agape.
Again? Are you joking? Who told you la?
Daisy demanded, still chewing on her meat bop.
Who else? Kitty lo. Kitty and Araminta are the best of friends now. And ever since this latest miscarriage, she's been spending a lot of time at Kitty's house playing with Giselle.
She's completely heartbroken.
How often do you see Kitty and Giselle?
Lorena asked, marveling that Carol could be so forgiving of her ex-daughter-in-law, the same woman who had cheated on her son, Bernard, with a man Kitty met at the funeral of Carol's late husband, and who subsequently dragged Bernard through a particularly acrimonious divorce and custody battle. Of course, it didn't hurt that Carol abhorred her son's new lifestyle of yoga and that ridiculous Jurassic diet, both of which she considered to be satanic.
I go over to Kitty's at least once a week, and Giselle comes to church with me every Sunday,
Carol proudly reported.
Is it healthy for Araminta to be playing with your granddaughter when she just lost her own baby?
Nadine wondered out loud.
Ayah, I'm sure old Mrs. Koo must be giving Araminta so much pressure to produce a grandson.
It's been 5 years since she married Colin.
My Nikki and Rachel have been married for 2 years now, and they still won't give me a grandchild,
Eleanor complained.
But Araminta is still young. She has plenty of time, la,
Nadine argued.
With all of Dorothy Koo's side disinherited, Puan's side good for nothings, and Nigel Koo running off and marrying that Russian cabaret singer, who is obviously too old to sekia.
Hokkien for bear a child.
Colin and Araminta are the last hope to carry on the Koo name,
Daisy commented. Having been born a Wong of the tin mining Wongs, Daisy had an encyclopedic knowledge of Singapore's social history. The ladies all shook their heads, casting pitiful glances at Araminta, who to anyone else but these women's hypercritical eyes looked perfectly gorgeous and lovely in her yellow-striped mini-dress from Jacquemus.
Well, Eleanor, your niece Astrid just arrived.
There's one girl who never seems to age, Carol observed.
All the women turned to look as Astrid descended the sweeping curved staircase with her mother Felicity Leong, the society queen Mrs. Lee Yong Chen, and another elderly lady decked out in a cobalt blue sequined hijab.
Who is that Malay woman wearing that ginormous ruby choker? If that center stone looks as big as it does from here, it must be the size of a lychee up close,
Lorena exclaimed. Having been married into the Lorient jewelry family for more than 3 decades, she definitely knew her rocks.
Oh, that's the Dowager Sultana of Perawak. She's staying with the Leongs, of course,
Eleanor reported.
Alamak, having royalty as house guests is such a nuisance, Daisy complained.
Lorena, like most of the other women in the ballroom, scrutinized Astrid from head to toe as she walked to her table wearing what appeared to be a crisp men's button-down shirt tucked into exquisitely cut navy and white gingham cigarette trousers.
It's true. Astrid actually looks younger and younger every time I see her. Isn't she in her late 30s by now? She looks like an MGS girl coming off the school bus.
Methodist Girls' School, which we Anglo-Chinese school, ACS boys, used to call Monkey Girls' School.
I bet you she must be sneaking off somewhere and getting things done.
I can tell you she hasn't had a thing done. She's not the type, Eleanor said.
It's how she puts it all together.
The other girls her age are dressed up like Christmas trees. But just look at Astrid.
Hair in a sleek ponytail. Ballet flats. Not a drop of jewelry except that cross. Is it turquoise? And that outfit. She looks like Audrey Hepburn on the way to a screen test.
Daisy said approvingly as she fished around in her new saline handbag for a toothpick.
Bloody hell. See what my snobby daughter-in-law forces me to carry? She gave me this fancy handbag for my birthday because she's embarrassed of being seen next to me when I'm carrying my no-name purse. But I can't ever find anything in here. It's so damn deep and there are so many damn pockets.
Daisy, will you please stop swearing? We are in the Lord's presence tonight, you know,
Carol admonished. As if on cue, the Christian Fellowship Banquet's hostess, Rosalind Fung, got up from her table and walked onto the stage. A short, plumpish woman in her mid-60s with a frizzy spiral perm, Rosalind was dressed in what seemed to be the regulation uniform of every middle-aged old-money Singaporean heiress. A sleeveless floral blouse, probably purchased from the clearance rack at John Little, taupe elastic waist pants, and orthopedic open-toe sandals. She smiled happily from the podium at her gathered friends.
Ladies, thank you all for coming tonight to join in fellowship with Christ. A quick warning to everyone before we start. I'm told that the laksa,
a spicy noodle soup dish served with cockles, fish cake, and thick rice noodles,
is dangerously spicy tonight. I don't know what happened, but even Mary Lau, who everyone knows has to have extra chili with everything, told me that she buay tahan,
Singlish for cannot endure it,
the laksa. Now, before we continue to nourish our stomachs and our souls, Bishop Si Bei Xian will begin our program with a blessing.
As the bishop started one of his notoriously tedious prayers, bizarre noises could be heard coming from behind one of the ballroom side doors. It sounded as if there was a heated argument going on outside, followed by a series of muffled bangs and scrapes. Suddenly, the door burst open.
No! I said you cannot go in!
A female attendant shouted forcefully, breaking the silence. Something could be heard running along the side of the ballroom, wailing intermittently like an animal. Daisy prodded the woman at the next table who had stood up to get a better view.
What can you see? She asked anxiously. Don't know la. It looks like some crazy homeless person,
came the reply.
What do you mean homeless? There is no such thing as a homeless person in Singapore,
Eleanor exclaimed. Astrid, who was seated at the far end beside the stage, wasn't fully aware of what was happening until a woman with extremely disheveled hair, wearing stained yoga sweats, suddenly appeared at her table, dragging two young girls in school uniforms behind her. Mrs. Lee Yong Chen let out a gasp and clutched her purse tightly to her chest, as Astrid realized in astonishment that the two girls were Chloe and Delphine, Charlie Wu's daughters, and the deranged-looking woman was none other than Charlie's estranged wife, Isabel. The last time Astrid had seen Isabel, she had been exquisitely attired in Dior Couture at the Venice Biennale. Now she was completely unrecognizable. What were they doing here in Singapore? Before Astrid could properly react, Isabel Wu took her eldest daughter by the shoulders and turned her toward Astrid.
Here she is!
She screamed, spit forming at the corners of her mouth.
I want you to see her with your own eyes! I want you to see the whore that spreads her legs for your daddy!
Everyone at the table gasped, and Rosalind Fung immediately made the sign of the cross, as if it would somehow protect her ears from absorbing the obscenity. The hotel's security guards came rushing up, but before Isabel could be properly restrained, she grabbed the nearest bowl of laksa and hurled it at Astrid. Astrid backed away reflexively, and the bowl ricocheted off the edge of the table, splashing scalding extra spicy soup all over Felicity Leong, Mrs. Lee Yong Chen, and the Dowager Sultana of Perawak. Chapter 3. Radio City Music Hall, New York. Patti Smith was in the middle of belting out Because the Night when Nicholas Young's cell phone began lighting up like a firecracker in his jeans pocket. Nick ignored the call, but when the lights came up after the concert's final encore, he glanced at the screen and was surprised to find one voicemail from his cousin Astrid, another from his best friend Colin Koo, and 5 text messages from his mother. His mother never texted. He didn't think she even knew how to text. The messages read, Eleanor Young, 4?Z Nikki #. Eleanor Young,
please check me at once. Where are you?
Eleanor Young,
oi, why don't you answer any of your fines?
Eleanor Young,
Amma had a massive heat attack.
Eleanor Young,
call home now.
Nick handed the phone to his wife Rachel and sank into his seat. After the euphoric high of the concert, he felt like someone had suddenly knocked all the wind out of him. Rachel read the text messages quickly and looked up at Nick in alarm.
Don't you think you'd better call?
Yeah, I guess I should, Nick replied.
Let's get out of here first, though. I need some air.
As the two of them exited Radio City Music Hall, they hurried across 6th Avenue to avoid the crowd still milling under the famous marquee. Nick paced around the plaza outside the Time and Life building to make his call. There was that familiar dead pause for a few seconds, usually followed by the distinctive Singapore ringtone. But today, his mother's voice abruptly came onto the line before he was ready for it.
Nikki? Nikia, is that you?
Yes, Mum. It's me. Can you hear me?
Ayah, why did you take so long to call back? Where are you?
I was at a concert when you called.
A concert? Did you go to Lincoln Center?
No, it was a rock concert at Radio City Music Hall.
What? You went to see those rockette girls with the kicking legs?
No, Mum. It was a rock concert, not the rockettes.
A rock concert? Alamak! I hope you wore earplugs.
I read that people are losing their hearing younger and younger now because they keep going to those rock and roll concerts. All those hippies with long hair are going stone deaf. Serves them right.
The volume was fine, Mom. Radio City has some of the best acoustics in the world. Where are you?
I just left Mount E. Ahmad is driving me to Carol Tai's. She's having a chili crab party.
I had to get out of that hospital ward because it was getting too chaotic.
Felicity is being her usual bossy mother hen. She said I couldn't go in to see Amma because too many people had been to see her already, and they had to start restricting the number of visitors. So I just sat outside for a while and nibbled away on the buffet with your cousin Astrid. I wanted to show my face, so no one would dare say I didn't do my duty as the wife of the eldest son.
Well, how is Amma?
Nick didn't want to admit it to himself, but he was rather anxious to know whether his grandmother was dead or alive.
They managed to stabilize her, so she's okay for now.
Nick looked up at Rachel and mouthed, "She's okay." As Eleanor continued her update,
they put her on a morphine drip, so she's sedated at the moment in the royal suite. But Prof. Un's wife told me that it's not looking good.
Prof. Un's wife is a doctor?
Nick asked, confused.
No la, but she's his wife. She heard it straight from the horse's mouth that Amma's not going to last long.
Alamak, what do you expect? She has congestive heart failure, and she's 96 years old. It's not like they can operate at this point.
Nick shook his head derisively. Patient confidentiality was obviously not high on Francis Un's list. What is Mrs. Un even doing there?
Don't you know Mrs. Un is the niece of Singapore's First Lady?
She brought along the First Lady, Great Aunt Rosemary Sien, and Lillian May Tan. The entire floor at Mount E has been sealed off to the public. It's become a restricted VVIP floor because of Amma, Mrs. Lee Yong Chen, and the Dowager Sultana of Perawak. There was a bit of a fuss over who would be put in the royal suite.
The royal suite at Mount Elizabeth Hospital was originally built by the royal family of Brunei for their private use, but is now open to other VVIP patients.
As the Malay ambassador insisted that the Dowager Sultana had to get it, But then the first lady intervened and told the hospital's chief officer, "This isn't even up for discussion. Of course Shang Sui must have the royal suite."
"Wait a minute. Mrs. Li and the Sultana of Perawak? I'm not following you."
"Ayo, you didn't hear what happened?"
"Isabel Wu had a psychotic breakdown and kidnapped her children from school and flew them to Singapore and barged into Rosalind Fung's Christian Fellowship banquet and threw a bowl of extra hot laksa at Astrid, but missed, and it landed all over the ladies. But thank God Felicity was wearing one of her pasar malam polyester dresses from that tailor of hers in Tiong Bahru."
Literally, night market in Malay. The pasar malam is a traveling outdoor street market where many bargains are sold. In this instance, Eleanor is implying that Felicity Young's custom-tailored outfit looks like a cheap schmata from an outdoor street market.
"So the soup did nothing to her and slid right off like Teflon, but poor Mrs. Li and the Dowager Sultana got drenched and are recovering from first-degree burns."
"Okay, you've completely lost me there." Nick shook his head in exasperation as Rachel gave him a questioning look.
"I thought of all people you'd know. Isabel Wu accused Astrid of spreading her legs. I mean having an affair with her husband, Charlie. Right in front of Bishop Si Bei Sien and everyone in the banquet hall.
Ayo, it's so shameful. Now it's out in the open and all of Singapore is talking about it.
Is it true? Is Astrid Charlie's mistress?"
"She's not his mistress, Mom. That much I can tell you," Nick said carefully.
"You and your cousin, always keeping secrets from me. Poor Astrid looked completely shell-shocked at the hospital, but she was still trying to play the gracious hostess to all the visitors. Anyway, when are you coming home?"
Nick paused for a moment before saying decisively, "I'm not coming back."
"Nikki, don't talk nonsense. You must come home. Everyone is coming back.
Your father is already on his way from Sydney. Uncle Alfred arrives in a few days. Auntie Alex and Uncle Malcolm are flying in from Hong Kong, and even Auntie Kat is coming down from Bangkok. And get this, supposedly all your Thai cousins are coming too. Can you believe that? Those high and mighty royal cousins of yours never deigned to come down to Singapore. But I'm telling you."
Eleanor paused, glancing at her driver before cupping her hands over the cell phone and whispering rather indiscreetly, "They all sense that this is the end.
And they want to show their faces at Ama's bedside, just to make sure they're in the will."
Nick rolled his eyes.
"Only you would say something like that. I'm sure that's the last thing on anyone's mind."
Eleanor laughed derisively. "Oh my goodness, don't be so naive. I guarantee you that's the only thing going through everyone's mind. The vultures are all circling like mad. So get yourself on the next flight. This is your last chance to make up with your grandmother."
She lowered her voice again.
"And if you play your cards right, you might still get Tyersal Park."
"I think that ship has sailed. Trust me, I don't think I'll be welcomed."
Eleanor sighed in frustration.
"You're wrong about that, Nikki. I know Ama won't close her eyes until she sees you one last time."
Nick ended the call and quickly updated Rachel on his grandmother's condition and the Isabel Wu hot soup incident. Then he perched on the edge of the plaza's reflecting pool, suddenly feeling drained. Rachel sat beside him and put her arm around his shoulder, not saying anything. She knew how complicated things were between him and his grandmother. They had once been extremely close, Nick being the adored only grandson who bore the Young surname, and the only grandchild who had lived at Tyersal Park. But it had now been more than 4 years since they had last seen or spoken to each other. And it was all because of her. Sui had ambushed them during what was supposed to be a romantic getaway in the Cameron Highlands of Malaysia, commanding Nick to end his relationship with Rachel. But Nick had not only refused,
he had uncharacteristically insulted his grandmother in front of everyone, something that had probably never happened to this revered woman in her entire life. Over the past few years, the gulf had only widened as Nick defiantly married Rachel in California, leaving his grandmother and the majority of his large family off the wedding invitation list.
"This girl does not come from a proper family."
Rachel still vividly remembered Sui's condemnation, and for a moment, a slight chill went down her spine. But here in New York, Shang Tsui's shadow didn't loom as large, and for the past 2 years, she and Nick had been blissfully enjoying married life far away from any family interference. Rachel had occasionally tried to see if anything could be done to mend the fences between Nick and his grandmother, but he had stubbornly refused to talk about it. She knew Nick wouldn't react so angrily if he didn't care about his grandmother so much. Rachel looked Nick squarely in the face.
"You know, as much as it pains me to admit it, I think your mother's right. You should go home."
"New York is my home," Nick replied flatly.
"You know what I mean. Your grandmother's situation sounds really precarious."
Nick stared up at the windows of Rockefeller Center, still lit at this late hour, avoiding Rachel's eyes.
"Look, I'm starving. Where should we go for a late supper? Bouvette? Blue Ribbon Bakery?"
Rachel realized it was pointless to push him any further.
"Let's do Bouvette. I think their coq au vin is just what we need right now."
Nick paused for a moment. "Maybe we ought to avoid any place with hot soup tonight." Chapter 4. Mount Elizabeth Hospital, Singapore. After 5 hours at the hospital's intensive care unit, alternately sitting beside her grandmother, managing the visiting dignitaries, managing her mother's nerves, and managing the caterers from Mingjiang that has set up a buffet in the VIP visitors' lounge. Yes, you can be sure, Mingjiang's legendary wood-fired Beijing duck, with a first serving of crispy duck skin dipped in fine granulated sugar, wrapped in homemade pancakes with sweet sauce, shredded leeks and cucumbers, followed by a second serving of the sliced duck and fried noodles, was part of the impromptu ICU buffet organized by Felicity Leong. Astrid needed a break and some fresh air. She took the elevator down to the lobby and walked out to the little grove of palm trees adjacent to the side entrance off Jalan Elok and began texting with Charlie on WhatsApp.
"Astrid Leong Tu. Sorry I couldn't talk earlier. No phones allowed in the ICU."
Charles Wu.
"No worries. How's your ama?"
ALT. "Resting comfortably at the moment, but the prognosis isn't good."
CW. "So sorry to hear that."
ALT.
"Are Isabel and the kids all right?"
CW.
"Yes. Their plane landed a couple of hours ago, and thankfully Isabel's mother managed to keep her calm during the flight. She's been admitted to Hong Kong Sanatorium, and her doctors are attending to her.
The kids are okay. Bit shaken up.
Chloe's glued to her phone as usual, and I'm lying here next to Delphine while she sleeps."
ALT.
"I have to tell you, they were such angels through it all. I could tell they were trying to stay composed during the whole ordeal. Delphine dashed to the side of Mrs. Lee Yongchen, while Chloe tried to help calm Isabel down as she was being restrained."
CW. "I am so sorry for this."
ALT. "Come on, it wasn't your fault."
CW. "It is my fault. Should have seen this coming. She was supposed to sign off on the divorce settlement this week, and my lawyers were pressuring her. That's why she snapped. And my security team totally screwed up."
ALT. "Wasn't it the school that screwed up? Letting Isabel walk in and take them out of class in the middle of the school day?"
CW.
"She apparently put on an Oscar-worthy performance. With the way she looked, they really thought there was a family emergency."
This is what happens when you donate too much money to a school. They don't ever question you.
A.L.T. I don't think anyone could have anticipated this.
C.W.
Well, my security team should have. This was an epic fuck-up.
They never even saw Isabel and the kids exiting. They only had the front entrance under surveillance. Since Izzy went to die a season two, she knew all the secret ways to sneak out.
A.L.T.
O.M.G.
I didn't think of that.
C.W. She took them out through the laundry room door and they hopped on the MTR straight to the airport.
B.T.W. We discovered how she knew where to find you.
Rosalind Fung tagged you in a Facebook pic from last month's Christian Fellowship event.
A.L.T.
Really? I'm never on FB.
Look at it about once a year.
C.W. Isabel's mom is FB friends with Rosalind. She messaged her 3 days ago asking if you would be at this event, and Rosalind said yes, and even told her you'd be seated at the table of honor.
A.L.T.
So that's how she knew how to find me in that crowd. I was so shocked when she started screaming at me.
C.W.
I guess the cat's out of the bag. Everyone must be talking about us now.
A.L.T.
I have no idea. Probably.
C.W.
What did your mother say? Did she go ballistic when she found out about us?
A.L.T.
Mum's said nothing so far. I'm not sure she even connected all the dots. When it happened, she was too busy dabbing tissues on Mrs. Lee and the Sultana. And then in the midst of all that, Araminta Lee rushed up to us and said, "Haven't you heard? Your grandmother had a heart attack."
C.W.
You've really had the day from hell.
A.L.T.
Not compared to your kids. I'm sorry they had to go through this, seeing their mother in that state.
C.W.
They've seen it before. It's just never been this bad.
A.L.T.
I wanted to hug them. I wanted to get them out of there and fly them back to you myself, but it was total chaos with everything happening all at once.
C.W.
You need a hug.
A.L.T.
Would be so nice.
C.W.
I don't know how you put up with me and all the shit that keeps happening.
A.L.T.
I could say the same myself.
C.W.
Your shit ain't half as crazy as mine.
A.L.T.
Just you wait. With Ama in the condition she's in, I don't know what's going to happen anymore.
There's going to be a family invasion this week, and it's not going to be pretty.
C.W. Is it going to be like Modern Family?
A.L.T.
More like Game of Thrones, the red wedding scene.
C.W.
Oh boy, speaking of weddings, does anyone know about our plans?
A.L.T.
Not yet. But I think this might be the perfect opportunity to start prepping my family, letting some of my closer relatives know that I'm divorcing Michael and there's a new man in my life.
C.W.
Is there a new man in your life?
A.L.T.
Yes. His name is Jon Snow.
C.W.
Hate to break it to you, but Jon Snow is dead.
In 2015, the world was most preoccupied about figuring out if the economy would continue to recover, how to keep the Ebola outbreak in Africa from becoming a global pandemic, where ISIS terrorists would strike next after the horrendous Paris attacks, how to help Nepal after its devastating earthquakes, who would be the frontrunners in the next U.S. presidential campaign, and whether Jon Snow, Lord Commander of the Night's Watch and one of the heroes in George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones television series, really died in the season finale.
A.L.T.
No, he's not. You'll see.
C.W. Seriously, I'm here if you need me. Do you want me to come down?
A.L.T.
No, it's fine. Chloe and Delphine need you.
C.W.
I need you. I can send the plane any time.
A.L.T.
Let's see how this week goes with my family, and then we can really begin making some plans.
C.W. I'll be counting the minutes. ALT.
Me too. XO, XO, XO.